classes.
Okay, it's the 12th of August, 2018. And we're in chapter 23 of the book of Acts, and we're reading and discussing the same. All right, and Brother Yeshua will be reading. Nice and loudly. You want to take the recorder, brother, or
just put it on the table?
Yeah, if you find it, please.
That end, please. I'm going to go section by section.
Okay.
And we'll stop and discuss, or we're just going to read through and then.
And feel free to interrupt me if you feel like we need to stop at a subsection.
Should we raise our hand? Who wants to raise our hand?
For sure.
Well, I might not notice, so how about you just speak up?
Okay.
I'm going to read a couple of verses from the last chapter just to get our memory going on where we're at. So then the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" He said, "Yes." The commander answered, "With a large sum I obtained the citizenship." And Paul said, "But I was born a citizen." Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him, and the commander was also afraid after he had found out that he was a Roman. And because he had bound him, the next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." And the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. For you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?" And those who stood by said, "Do you revile God's high priest?" Then Paul said, "I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.' But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, 'Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged.' And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. Then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, 'We find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God.' Now, when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks."
Okay, can we stop there? Because there's a lot of stuff that we could talk about in there. And So one of the first things that I want to go back to what you were pointing out before we started the reading and recording about what is our definition of Pharisee. And in the modern church, we think, people think if you're trying to obey God's will or God's law, that you're a Pharisee, and so they'll call you a Pharisee trying to mock you and make you feel bad because you're trying to be obedient to the gospel. And we respond kind of in kind by saying, no, a Pharisee is somebody who is a hypocrite. We're not hypocrites because we're obeying the law. You're the whited tomb, like what Paul is saying there, right, to the chief priests. So that's where we kind of get that idea that the hypocrite is the Pharisee. And yet, as you rightly pointed out earlier, well, Paul called himself a Pharisee and a son of a Pharisee. He wasn't ashamed of that. And so a Pharisee would have been a student or teacher of the law and someone who kept the law according to the written and oral traditions of the Jews.
So it would be a sin to be a Pharisee. It would be a sin to be a hypocrite Pharisee. It would
be a sin to be a whitewashed tomb. Right. Back to our point, how we're trying to define and deal with the accusations that come against us for preaching, etc. So,
can you repeat that one sentence that you just said about what a Pharisee is? I got a little distracted.
Okay.
It was just one sentence.
A Pharisee is a student and a teacher of the law, a keeper of the law. They would have believed the resurrection, as it explains there within the chapter.
And by the law, are you referring to a group of books?
Mosaic law. The Torah. They would have kept the Psalms, and Proverbs would have been part of their studies too, and Ecclesiastes and the Judges and the histories of the Jews, that kind of thing.
So the Sadducees didn't follow the law?
The resurrection, as it explains there in the
chapter. Oh, right, but I mean, regarding those specific details you just mentioned about the Pharisees, I'm wondering, are the Sadducees believing those same things?
I don't know that detail. That's a good question. You know that detail.
I know what Jesus said. Do as the Pharisees say. He didn't say do as the Sadducees say. He said do as the Pharisees said. So the Pharisees had the right doctrine. They just didn't practice it. They were hypocrites.
Whereas the Sadducees that we see here would have at least had some wrong doctrine.
So you could stay in fellowship with me if I am a Pharisee?
As long as you're not a hypocrite Pharisee, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. But I want to. Did we have another thought about the Pharisee thing, or
are we done with that part?
I mean, yeah, because I wanted to bring up something else.
I have no problem. I just want you to go turn that off, please. I need you to speak up louder so you can get heard in the recording.
The thing that I'm always elated by when I'm reading this part.
Thank you.
Is the absolute brilliance of Paul. I'm a Pharisee. He sees the mixed company. And he says, I'm a Pharisee. It was so brilliant because he brought in division. He knew the Pharisees and Sadducees. They came together against Paul. And Paul noticed it and said, hey, wait a second, you know. And he says, I'm a Pharisee and I believe in a resurrection. And all of a sudden, you know, this big division comes in.
Well, the division was already there.
Right.
He was just amplifying in that moment.
Yep.
And the enemies of God were turning on themselves. We saw that happen yesterday during the preach, that the enemies of God were turning on themselves. I think when Tim was preaching, and they were biting and devouring each other instead of biting us.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it was just very interesting the way Paul used his Roman citizenry. He used his Pharisee. He used who he learned under, Gamaliel. He used all these things as tools to do what?
To teach, to
further the gospel.
preach the gospel, right?
Yeah, he did this all to further the gospel, as we'll read in the chapter later on, too, that it's like, you'll see that everything was done, he knew what he was doing, he had a plan in his head, and the Holy Ghost helped him through it, and he to notice that you're sitting there and you got all these people coming against you, and you realize that there's something that divides them, and then you bring up what that thing that divides them, and bam. Mm-hmm. So, and that, because he did that, as you've seen, they had to take him back into the castle.
No protection.
Yep.
So they tore it apart.
Yep.
Okay.
I got a question.
Sure.
On another topic. Mm-hmm. Are you done on that topic?
Yeah.
So, going back towards the beginning of the chapter, you know, about the high priest commanding him to be struck. Then Paul rebukes the high priest. And then he finds out that he was the high priest and says, okay, I shouldn't have done that.
What? I'm sorry, what was that part?
He finds out that it was the high priest he had just rebuked.
Yes, he was submissive to the authority.
And then Paul says that if he would have known that, he wouldn't have done it. And he quotes the scripture, which seems to say that what he did was wrong.
And then he changes the subject.
So did he do something wrong there or not? I mean, obviously he didn't have knowledge, right? He says, I did not know, brethren. Okay, but if he had the knowledge of the high priest, would that be sin for him to say what he did? Because, we have to look up that verse that he quotes. You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. That is at Exodus 22:28. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a command. I mean, we could double check that by going to Exodus 22:28.
I will say this, though, while I'm looking it up, that Stephen rebuked the Pharisees.
Oh, a lot of them.
And there could have been there could have been a leader in that people that he was rebuking. 22 what, brother? 28, I'm sorry?
22:28.
Thanks. 22:28 says, thou shalt not revile the gods, nor curse the ruler of thy people.
It says the gods?
Yeah, the gods.
That says do not revile God. 22:28.
Is that King James?
New King James.
Interesting.
So yours says shall not revile the gods.
Plural. Yeah, little g, obviously.
It says, revile not God.
You shall not revile God nor curse the ruler of your people.
Big G.
Does it make it a big G?
Big G. The big
one. That's serious.
That's very serious.
You better write that down.
Exodus 22:28. I'm writing it down right now.
Because remember Jesus back in the book of John study, he talked about ye were gods, right?
The magistrates.
Magisterium, yep. Right.
So this is a big thing.
Yeah. And of course you get people like, what's her name? Who's that teacher that my sister likes so much?
Joyce Meyer.
Teaching that you're gods.
Kenneth Copeland too, yeah.
Kenneth Copeland teaching you're gods. Well, they get that from somewhere. They're quoting scriptures. Now let's just deal with it. What does that mean? Well, the lords, he's a lord of lords, and the kings of the earth are called lords. And so obviously there's different authorities. Sarah called Sarai, or Sarah called Abraham lord. But obviously he's not God, not the living God.
Right.
So how does that all work out? It should be probably something we need to really dig deep into after we figure out what the definitions of the gospel are. So, but let's write down that question. Maybe you can post it on Facebook or something. But
that's a big difference. God, big G, God's little G.
Yeah, New King James and King James. You know, the modern thinker wants to jump right to, well, that's right. Modern thinking, that's right.
But our King James friends, King James only as friends, will just have a...
They will have a field day with that.
That's a big... That's well,
understandably.
Both. Right. I would say in this instance, both cannot be right.
Understandably.
So we're in agreement on that both cannot
be right. We're definitely in agreement that both cannot be right.
All
right,
good.
So okay. That was kind of like a side shoe.
Yeah,
yes,
definitely.
That was a side shoe, but it was an important one.
Very one.
Important. Yeah. Thanks so what we were talking about was, did Paul do something wrong there? If he knew that he was the high priest, would that be sin for him to
call him out?
Say what he said. No. Specifically, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, exclamation point, for you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?
Now, I think that is obvious hypocrisy, but maybe it was Paul's attitude leading up to that last part of that statement. His attitude, you know, God strike you. Maybe his heart wasn't right the way he said it. I don't know. But I don't think it's a sin to correct a ruler. Maybe it's a sin to correct him publicly.
Well, the person that, the soldier or whoever that strikes him, you know, says, he puts it as revile him, right? Mm. That he reviled. He puts it as a question, do you revile God's high priest? So this would maybe be another time to look at King James in that verse 4. Wait, excuse me. In Acts, how is it being described? Is it reviling?
It says revilers. And they stood by, said, and they that stood by, it wasn't just one person.
Okay.
It says, and they that stood by said, revilest thou God's high priest?
I'm sorry, I was stumbling. Verse 5, how does it quote the scripture of the Old Testament?
Then said Paul, I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people.
Okay, so speaking evil.
Right.
It wasn't how he said it, it was the fact that he spoke evil of somebody.
Evil of the ruler.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't... Once again, the scriptures are silent here. All he does is say... He doesn't say, I'm sorry I did it. He doesn't say, I should have
said it. Well, he confesses. Confesses is an agreement.
Yeah,
and he even quotes why believes he's in agreement.
Okay.
It's like, oh yeah, I broke the law. It's... Ordinance number 503, Nashville City Code.
Thou shalt not block the sidewalk or the walking bridge. Right. Yeah, I mean, he does, he accepts the correction, right? Looks like he accepted the correction from them. And he did not know that he was the high priest, so he did it out of ignorance. But then he... I will point out, though, that he quickly changes the subject.
Oh, yeah, I do recognize that.
Yeah, he very quickly changes the subject and causes the division in the council or the assembly. Or,
right.
So
if it was wrong for him to do that, is that then... showing that there are exceptions to... there's kind of like a kind of like Ecclesiastes, how it puts it, a time for this, a time for that. So, like, it was not a time to rebuke. It was not a time to speak evil of somebody. And so when we're looking at Timothy, letter written to him, when it says reprove, strong word, rebuke, strong word, in season and out of season.
That's all the time.
Is that 100%? Or are there still exceptions?
Reprove, rebuke, exhort.
Well, I still think it goes back to, it must be that those that stood around, their testimony was true about him reviling. It's both him reviling the wrong attitude towards the ruler and his ignorance of the person is the ruler. Even though the ruler is striking contrary to the law, that's true. And Paul rebuked him, which would be true, even if he is a ruler, it's still true that the ruler shouldn't have done that. But it must have been Paul's attitude towards the ruler that Paul is now making deference to.
Okay.
Yeah, because he was accused of being a reviler.
Okay, let's consider that. So then we would be saying that he can't plead ignorance. He's a reviler. He's not holy.
No, I'm saying both and, not either or. He was initially starting out in ignorance. He didn't know it was a ruler. And then his ignorance led him to reviling the ruler that he didn't know was a ruler. And when he found out it was a ruler, he apologized.
Can I revile anyone legally?
No.
Reviling is a sin?
According to us.
According to the Bible, actually.
Well, there's differences in opinion about what reviling is, but we started out with this consideration saying, okay, let's suppose he did revile. Mm-hmm. So if all reviling is sin, we're saying he sinned, and it's not out of ignorance that he can plea about reviling. He can plea ignorance about, you know, about speaking evil of the high priest, but he can't plead ignorance on reviling. Right. And so if we're saying that he reviled, we're saying that he was then sinning there and not being holy.
Right.
And if he died, he would be in big, big trouble.
Okay.
Am I being reasonable here?
What do you say?
Well, I think that's kind of like, I don't think that we can, just because people that stood by with hatred in their heart, just because they're accusing him of saying that he was reviling, I don't think that then we can say, oh, he must have reviled. Kind of like John 9:31, okay? That one is used to support by some people that, you know, God doesn't hear the prayer of sinners. Mm-hmm. That's true, but because of, like, who's talking, just because someone in the story says it doesn't mean, you know, it's true.
In that case, it was, though, John 9:31. It was a true statement. But I agree with, I understand what you're saying, though. I'm not exactly
just
sure,
like,
where you're...
Friend of sinners, very similar thing, right? Haven't you?
Well, John 9:31 lines up with Isaiah 59:1-2 and many other verses too.
And Psalm 66:18.
Yeah, I hope I don't trip you up on that. Do you see?
No,
this?
I kind of we just offshot again, but
I'm bringing up similarities. I'm not dwelling on that topic. These are giving examples of someone saying something. You can't just simply go by what they say. If John 9:31 was the only verse in the Bible that was alluding to the fact that God does not hear the prayer of sinners, then you couldn't confidently say God doesn't hear the prayer of sinners. You can confidently say it because of other verses in the Bible.
Right. That's right, because I couldn't confidently say it because of who was saying it at the time in John 9:31.
If Jesus said it, hey, that'd be a different story.
Right.
But it's just a dude.
It's right. Just dudes.
That I don't know what translation that was. Sorry,
dude. Any translation?
I think there's also a possibility here because once again, it's not really saying, "I'm sorry, I did that." He's saying it. Maybe their perception was that he was reviling, but he wasn't. Maybe the intent of his heart was right. Because they were striking him or smiting him contrary to the law.
Yeah, they had still no right didn't have to smite authority him. To do that.
They didn't have the authority to do it because he is a Pharisee. Had they known he was a Pharisee, they would not have struck him.
No, because he's a Roman, is why they feared.
Oh, yeah, I think that they did wrong. Okay, right. But I didn't think that we were talking about whether they did wrong or not. We're talking about whether Paul did wrong or not. Right. And looking at Paul's own mouth, we see that he confesses.
Mm-hmm.
And cites the ordinance number.
Yep, once again, I understand that. But he might be doing that because their perception is wrong. Scripture doesn't specify. And then he quickly moves on. And brings in a division. He changes the subject. Let's not dwell on this. Let's dwell on your division here. He goes right into it. So I mean.
Well, I mean, if he has a speck in his eye, he needs to take care of it, right? Before dealing
again,
with
the word "if." Then
the just, other people.
The right? word "if" means it's a question mark. So I think that he might have said that because of their perception, or he did say it because he sinned and this was in repenting. So, the Bible doesn't specify here.
Well, I think he did get the speck out of his eye by confessing.
Right.
Okay.
And it is arguably even maybe not a speck because he did it in ignorance. So there's two things that we've talked about so far. We've talked about, did he do wrong? Did he revile? You guys seem like to say like he might have because of the people that stood by were accused him of reviling.
That was the accusation.
It's not just the accusation, it's his non-denial. So he's making a confession and he's not denying what they're accusing him of.
Well, Jesus didn't deny a bunch of accusations. That doesn't mean he did it.
I agree with that, but when Jesus was smited, he didn't say anything at all. Right, when Jesus was struck on the face, no, I'm sorry, that's wrong. Jesus did say something. He said the same thing. He said, "Why do you strike me? And I was with you in the temple every day. You didn't attack me then. Why are you attacking me now?" And Paul's response is, "Why do you smite me? Contrary to the law," which is still true.
Yeah.
He didn't. So he didn't every accusation. So my point is, just because someone doesn't respond to an accusation doesn't mean that they are in agreement with it.
I think it might be a good idea to do a little extra study, look at the commentaries on it, possibly, and see what their view is on it, possibly.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
because
we seem to be spinning our wheels here, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't, unless you can give us a more clear answer of what you think it is.
I don't think he reviled. I think that he spoke evil of a ruler of their people. He confesses it. And he cites even the scripture that he broke in ignorance.
Yeah, because he said, "I did not know."
Okay.
I think, yeah, so he admitted to speaking evil, but he did not admit to being a reviler.
Right, so if he did revile and he's not confessing, but rather dealing with other people's sin, because reviling is a sin, right? And that just doesn't seem like he's doing very good.
Well, it's like we found out with all the open-air community discussions about reviling and upbraiding, that Jesus, I mean, it's still there. One of the definitions of upbraid is to revile.
No, rail.
Okay, rail.
That's not a... I don't agree with that.
Yeah, that...
That word shows up in Strong's Dictionary, but I don't think every word listed in Strong's Dictionary is a synonym to the words in that list.
That's another subject for...
It's okay. How to use Strong's Dictionary, a tool. How do you use it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I agree. You could use it wrongly, for sure.
Yep.
Okay. Onward and upward.
Okay. Yep. So we ended at verse 10?
Yep.
Oh, one more thing from that section. Second time I've got my glasses today. Okay. One more thing from that section. Real quick. It says in Paul, or verse 1, Paul earnestly beholding the council said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." I'm supposing from the day he was knocked off the horse by Jesus until this day that he appeared before the council.
I'm sorry, what verse number is that?
Verse 1.
And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day."
Of course, this is the intro to Paul's defense of himself as he is brought before the chief priests.
Yes, so he was murdering Christians.
Right.
In good conscience.
No, that's why I quantified what I said with
from
the time he became Paul, not Saul, but Paul.
Yeah, he even says "and Paul." He doesn't say "and Saul." He says "and Paul" there.
And Saul and Paul said, "I've always lived in good conscience."
No, well, I think he was living according to his conscience, wasn't he?
Right.
He thought that was the right thing to do. Just like we see in the New Testament letters when it says people will
think they're doing God a favor.
Think they're doing God a favor.
Right. Good point. But that wasn't my supposition. My supposition was his conscience was good. And it does say all good conscience. Conscience was good from the time he repented. That's what I'm supposing.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that because I think Paul's conscience bothered him.
About Stephen, yeah. Especially.
Because he does mention that in the last chapter, if I'm correct, right? No, or the chapter before that where he talks about, "I stood and they brought me their garments to hold their garments while they stoned Stephen." And that's him admitting his guilt. So if he's admitting his guilt there, he couldn't have been in good conscience while he was doing that. But
well, yeah, once he obtained knowledge,
right.
Yeah, people can look back at their past and be like, at that time, they thought they were doing the right thing. Later in time, they get knowledge, look back and be like, "Ooh, yeah, I did wrong there."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once again, it doesn't really specify other than we could say, "I live in good conscience before God until this day." It doesn't specify.
Right.
When it's
so there. They don't absolutely know.
No.
Okay, I'm sorry to bog us down there. Let's go on to verse 11 then, I guess. You want to continue, brother?
Sure. I'm going to start at 10 just to refresh our memories. "Now when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. But the following night the Lord stood by him and said, 'Be of good cheer, Paul. For as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, So you must also bear witness at Rome. And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul.
Wow.
Now there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. They came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him. But we are ready to kill him before he comes near." So when Paul's sister's son heard of their ambush, he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, "Take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the commander and said, "Paul, the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you." Then the commander took him by the hand, went aside, and asked privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him, and now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you." So the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, "Tell no one that you have revealed these things to me."
So I'm going to point out something. I don't think we're going to get the answer to this question, but once again, the King James and the New King James is in disagreement again. And it's strange because the King James, in this story, the 40 men that made the curse, it says here, let me find the actual verse here, sorry. Okay, verse 12 in the King James. "And when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse." The New King James says oath.
Okay.
And then again, when it's repeated again, the King James says curse again. The New King James says oath. But when the boy tells the story, in the King James it says oath. And so I just thought that was very interesting. Contrast differences there. A curse, binding yourself by a curse, or binding yourself by an oath. Which, and then when it's like the King James almost kind of contradicts too a little bit, because the King James says curse twice, and then the third time when the boy mentions it, it's mentioned as oath.
That is very interesting.
I don't know if anybody's got any thoughts. Probably not. But
maybe one involves you explicitly indicating wrath to come upon you, or some bad thing where that would be the curse, and then the oath would just be you doing what we have said we feel comfortable with doing in certain circumstances.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, let me Okay, so the curse involves the threat.
If you break the oath.
The curse involves the threat. So, whereas an oath is just a promise to do or not to do something.
Yes.
Like I could take an oath to give somebody land in the future, or, right? Or, but a curse would be, we're going to take that guy out and beat him up.
And if we don't,
right, yeah, we're going to add to that by showing our zeal to get it done. We're going to not eat or drink until it's finished.
Right, so then that begs the question, is the King James right here or the New King James right? And are they both right? And or? It's a tough one, ain't it?
Well, the curse sounds a lot stronger and their threat is very strong, so I would tend to agree with King James the way they translated this.
I think it goes like this. All curses are oaths, but not all oaths are curses.
That's a really good way to say it. All curses are oaths, but not all oaths are curses.
Yep.
So when somebody takes an oath to uphold the Constitution, that's not a curse?
Depends on what you want me to do. You want me to be a military guy? Or you just
police officer, military,
be a Secretary of State?
President? So the president takes an oath, mm-hmm. which he did, puts his hand on the Bible,
right.
and swears the oath. Mm-hmm. Right? Is he swearing a curse or an oath? I'm not.
Well, our Constitution is not openly cursing the world. I mean, it's not there to aggress upon people, but defend itself, defend our country and our people from
the republic in which it stands.
From, you know, outer elements or forces that are trying to destroy it.
Right.
So.
Okay. Yeah, I think I. So in this case, they made a curse because they wanted to kill Paul. So it was the curse is an evil oath. And an oath is, can a curse be an evil oath?
Well, evil can mean destruction or morally ungood. Destruction is not always bad.
Okay.
God created evil. So.
Sent lying spirits.
He sent forth the lying spirit.
Yeah. Okay. I think that answers my question. Thank you.
Thanks for bringing it up. That was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad you were able to help me with that one because I was having, as I was reading this through the week, I was having a hard time with it. The two different translations, which is why I'm glad you read from the New King James to remind me of that question.
Kind of like getting stuck on the bridge yesterday and ended up being a good thing.
Yeah, stuck on the bridge between the New King James and the King James.
I don't know what that means. I don't know what it means either, dear. It says in this commentary here, in this Bible, it says concerning this verse 12, or an oath of execration. Now, if it said execution, that'd be one thing, but execration, I don't know what that means. So, grab the dictionary, Daniel, please.
I think he's looking at
execration?
Execration. E-X-E-C-R-A-T-I-O-N. Come on.
He's looking it up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I don't know
what you're there for.
You can go get the 1828.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, grab the green.
Nice.
Bible of dictionaries.
An angry denouncement or curse. A protester's furious excretion of the police might end up getting her arrested. Use the word execration when you talk about something that's yelled or muttered angrily. The root word is execrare, which means to hate or curse in Latin. Boom.
Say, all you college students, stop execrating me. Oh, you're like,
huh? What? Not throwing anything
get
at
your,
you.
Get your smartphones out.
That's like I did.
Because your phones are smarter than you.
Yeah, we could maybe, could we put that on the sin list? Execrators?
Could go on a list, right?
Thanks for pointing that out, though. That was that execration thing there. Somebody's thought process there was the yeah, execration. And that word even sounds bad. It has a bad sound to it, doesn't it?
The letter X.
Yeah. It's yep. EX, though.
Oh, man. That's all exponentially worse.
Sorry. Oh, we should look at. Did you?
No. Can't find it. That's fine.
That's fine.
Yeah, Webster's. It's not the 1828 though. It says the act of cursing or denouncing, also the curse so uttered. An object of curses, something detested. So, it's definitely not a good thing. Right. They wanted to kill him. So they bound themselves by a curse. I agree with you that the King James got this one right, not the New King James.
It's a more fitting word. It's still an oath.
Right.
Right.
But it's a certain kind of oath.
Right. More narrowly defined.
Right.
But it still begs the question, why did the boy say oath and not curse? And why was it written differently in that? So that's interesting, but I may not know the answer.
Because the modern translators had the choice between a hard word and an easier word, they chose the easier word.
No, I'm talking about when the boy told the story in the King James, the boy says oath, doesn't say curse.
Well, because he's not doing the X word.
Yeah, so when he's reporting it...
He's not saying it with the X.
But Luke is reporting what they said. Anyways.
Okay.
Yep, that's it. Enough of that. Sorry. I don't know if there's anything else in
that
section.
We're going to split this audio. Where I think we're going, so.
Yeah. Well, that got us to verse 23, and there's 12 more verses.
48.
Okay.
That got us to verse 23.
Okay.
Come on, Cowboys.
And so the commander let the young man depart, and he commanded him to tell no one that you have received these things, revealed these things to me. And he called for two centurions, saying, prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night. And provide mounts to set Paul on, and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. He wrote a letter in the following manner. Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix. Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you, and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. Then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. The next day they left the horsemen to go on with him and return to the barracks. When they came to Caesarea and had delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. And when he understood that he was a Cilician, he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear you when your accusers also have come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. Period.
Reminded me of Jesus' story where he was taken from place to place, you know, because they didn't know what to do with him. He's a Roman citizen. He's a Pharisee. He's why do we deal with this guy, man? I just send him off to the next guy, you know, let him deal with it.
The third hour, 9 o'clock.
I think so. Well, one last point I'd like to make about that section is that the New Testament, well, the whole Bible, but the New Testament especially, which is obviously recognized to be 2,000 years old approximately, is filled with historical people and places that are verifiable by secular history. And so, like, you know, Felix the governor is verifiable. All these different authorities were, you know, Herod the Great, these different kings and princes and governors were verified. Pontius Pilate is verifiable by archaeology and secular history. And so it's unlike the Mormon books that are filled with all these fantasy cultures and places that are not archaeologically verified or historically verified from a different source, the Bible stands apart from that and other false religions, false gods that try to set themselves up. So really, really interesting, you know, my father is a doctor of history, so I'm no historian, surely, but Tacitus, the Roman historian. I'm always appealing to that in my apologetic to the sinners. Hey, here's an extra-biblical, secular Roman historian who is verifying that Jesus Christ existed and his disciples of the way, he wrote about them, and that it's reported he was alive after we crucified him. 3 days after he was dead and buried, by crucifixion, he was reported to be risen from the dead. And the followers of the way believed that. They had seen him and touched him and all those things. So, and then, of course, Josephus, a Jewish historian, same thing. We have verifiable, extra-biblical historians in history and archaeology supporting the writings of the New Testament. Not that we need it. You know, by faith we know it's true, by faith we believe and have that hope in him, but he proves himself to be true over and over again, and men who try to suppress that truth prove to be liars that they are over and over again. So that's all I have to say about that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, I think we'll wrap it up with that. Yes, sir, please.
Oh, thank you.